Good morning. May it please the Court. This case comes from the Bankruptcy Court, which held that a false statement of oral financial condition may not be a basis for fraud under 523A(b), which is set forth in the statute. But then the Bankruptcy Court determined that because of that, a false oral statement of financial condition also may not be willful and malicious conduct under 523A(6). Mm-hmm. On that basis, the adversary complaint count 2 is dismissed. It is the only count we are appealing today.
Now, if oral statements of a financial condition are actionable under 523A(6), doesn't that make the writing requirement in 523A(2)(b) meaningless?
It does not, because there's two different standards. This is akin to facts that could set up two torts under state law, one negligence, one strict liability. Merely because something can't fall under the strict liability provisions, which would be what
strict
B would
liability,
like.
Though, isn't that section about fraud?
Mm-hmm. Correct, Your Honor. I'm making an analogy. A state court
fraud is intentional misconduct.
Fraud is intentional misconduct where you know someone will lie. Willful and malicious conduct is slightly different.
That's what I don't understand.
Well, the argument
wouldn't all fraud be willful and malicious?
No, not all fraud is willful and malicious. Willful is defined as an intention that you know will cause the party injury, and malicious is without just cause or excuse. There's a slightly different...
Isn't that a good description of fraud?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Your Honor, the cases that I've cited have defined fraud differently. In bankruptcy court, fraud is defined more as the state law elements of a false statement of material fact upon which you know someone will rely to their detriment, or you intend someone to rely.
That sounds identical to your explanation of willful and malicious.
Well, one is you intend them to rely in fraud.
Right.
Willful and malicious, and you actually, under the kind of Hua versus Geiger case, have to intend the injury, not just the reliance. You actually have to intend the party to be injured.
Well, no, but look, when you make a deliberately false statement which you intend to induce reliance, you're obviously trying to injure the person you're making it to.
Your Honor,
why else would you make a false statement intended to induce reliance?
Because you may want them to assist you in the fraud by going out to another person and defrauding
them.
Right,
well, that's
them. Bad. Well, that would be
willful
bad.
Willful and malicious.
Well, it may not be willful and malicious because you don't intend to cause that party injury
then. You intend to cause the third party injury.
You would intend to cause a third party injury,
oh,
but not third party injury.
Really. Sketching is paper thin.
Well, many of the distinctions in bankruptcy cases.
And what's the point? I understand. Why would one want to make such a distinction?
Pardon me?
Why would one want to make such a distinction? What do you achieve by that? Except
because then, if you don't make that distinction, the only tort, the only single tort that is really barred from a non-dischargeability pleading, being allowed to plead, not for non-dischargeability, is an oral statement of financial condition that is false. That is the only tort of the many, many
okay,
myriad
but why
of
why do you think Congress made this distinction between oral and written frauds?
I think with respect to frauds, because of statute of fraud issues. Remember, a bankruptcy may come about 8 or 10 years after the oral statements occurred. It isn't like a statute of frauds in state court where you have 1 year to bring your, in Illinois, for instance, 1 year to bring your claim.
Right, statute of limitations.
Right, we're talking about, a statute of frauds, or where if you have an oral contract for a statute of frauds, and you can only bring that contract within so many years, or if you have an oral fraud, and you can only bring it, for instance, within 2 years in state court. That's a very limited amount of time. But when you're in a bankruptcy case, that fraud, that oral statement, it may have occurred 10 years ago. You may have been timely in state court and gotten your judgment, which is what happened here. The debtor may file bankruptcy 10 years later. Well, that judgment can still be enforced. And now you have an issue of who remembers what from 10 years ago.
And that's exactly the same with your case.
Correct. But in my case, I have to prove, if I get to prove willful and malicious, I have to improve what I perceive to be, what I believe the case is perceived to be, a slightly harder standard. And in doing that, I believe that the court has said, as I was trying to make the analogy, it's like negligence and strict liability. You may have something that's negligent, but it doesn't fit in strict liability, which is this more narrow standard. But you still get to prove it's negligent. It's just going to be harder for you to do. I believe the way this case came about, the Bogdanovich case, which it said in dicta, but not in its holding, that you cannot make an oral statement of financial condition under 523A6 stand as an allegation.
That case was prior to the Kalahua case, or however you pronounce it, right?
Kalahua versus Geiger, yes.
That case came after all these other cases.
I don't believe Kanahua did. I might be mistaken, but Bogdanovich was 2002. I thought Kanahua was right before that. I may be mistaken.
Right. But you're pleading that debtor's substantial certainty that his acts would cause creditor's loss evidences his subjective intent that creditor be injured. Is that your?
I believe that, if that's what you're reading from my pleading, that
is
what I've pledged in
the
amendment.
That's your attempt to conform to the Geiger, let's call it the Geiger case.
It is my attempt to conform to the Geiger case, that they intended the actual injury.
The Geiger case, of course, makes that distinction pretty clearly, but my question is, do you think this pleading is sufficient to bring you within that requirement of the Geiger case?
I do believe the amended adversary complaining is sufficient to bring me in the requirement of the Geiger case for the pleading stage. Whether, of course, as my opposing counsel has pointed out to me, whether or not I can prove that Mr. Gillespie and the debtor had that intended to cause injury is going to be a different question. But because I may or may not be able to prove it later is not a reason to make a policy decision that it should not be allowed to be pled. It is important how these cases came about, though. As I set forth in my brief, and I don't want to belabor the point too much, but there was one quote where a court was looking at 523 A and B, which is the fraud section, and said because B exempts oral statements of financial condition, you can't read it under the other subsection of that statute, which is A, which all relates to fraud. And the court said that the A-B dichotomy creates a curious anomaly. If stated orally, a false statement regarding debtor's financial condition, no matter how egregious, will not render the debt dischargeable. But that court, in Ray Talent, was talking about only the A-B dichotomy. What happened is the Ninth Circuit Bass, just about 6 months later, takes that quote and says, based upon that quote, if a party can't prove the elements of fraud under A-2, then the higher standard of A-6 can't be met. Therefore, the tort that does not fall under A or B is not provable and cannot be a basis for an A-6 claim. But what the court ignores there is it's only not provable under A or B because it's not allowed to be proved under A or B. It may be allowed to be proved under 6, and the court made a leap there. Based upon that case, Alicia Holstein and then Bogdanovich came down merely citing the cases before without the additional reasoning. Therefore, I think that the distinction is important and that you shouldn't allow only one tort to not be pled as non-tort.
How about Section 4? Does that have a writing requirement?
No, it does not. Section 4 does not have a writing requirement for fraud in a fiduciary capacity, embezzlement, or larceny.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you.
Ms. Sophia Bernstein? Mr. Sophia Bernstein, sorry.
Morning, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, we believe that the decision of the two courts below, the bankruptcy court and the district court sitting on appeal, should be affirmed. We think that the decision of the bankruptcy court judge was well-reasoned, and it's based on cases that were well-reasoned, and the reasoning goes back to the distinction that's made in the law between oral statements of fraud and written statements of fraud, and the evident intention of the Congress to make a distinction and to be an evidentiary or in reality and to exempt those from the non-discharge, from the discharge.
How do you account for the Geiger case's construction of Section 6? It seems to me to impose an additional requirement.
Well, I think that the Supreme Court in Geiger was concerned that the fraud be handled, and the intention of Congress was to handle fraud under the previous section, under the A2 section, and not to handle it under A6, and that's consistent with our position that fraud should be handled under the one provision of the statute, and that the purpose of...
Well, your position has got to be that once... But A2 is unnecessary as long as A6 is there if it has the same elements as A2. But the Geiger case, the Supreme Court said added one, it seemed to me.
Well, it seemed to me that the Supreme Court was just concerned that the statute be interpreted consistently and the one part of it not be interpreted in such a way as to render the other unnecessary.
Well, if I were to make the A2 unnecessary, if you add a requirement of an intention to injure in A6.
If you allow fraud claims to be brought under A6, then you're circumventing the purpose of putting in A2, which divided them up between, which talked very specifically about what kind of fraud
claims
could happen.
Well, is that consistent with the idea that 6 has got an additional requirement, a pleading requirement? Seems to me it isn't. But. The theory of these other cases is that A6 doesn't require anything beyond what A2 requires in terms of pleading.
Well, I think that the theory of all the cases is that the A6 does require that there be something pled other than a fraudulent statement of a financial condition. Yes, I think that in all the cases that talk about A6, in all the cases cited by the appellant that talk about A6, there were other things, other acts that were engaged in that were harmful, other tort acts that were engaged in that were harmful. There were acts.
Well, why would that render A2 without any function? If you have different requirements in A6,
I think as long as they have different functions, then it's not.
Is there a standard type of case that's brought under A6?
The cases that were cited, for example, there was one of the cases, I think it was Friar Lefebvre, that was talking about a doctor, for example, who performed cosmetic surgery. He did affirmative acts that were torts, that were not fraudulent torts. He also induced the patient.
So you're saying A6, although it might in principle encompass fraud, is really intended for
other torts.
These other types of torts.
I think that's what Geiger, I think, was trying to establish.
Is it?
Unless Your Honor, if you have any further questions, Your Honor, I would rest on a brief.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
And Ms. Johnson, how much time does she have? 1 minute?
Your Honor, to address the issue that you just raised, the Dorsey case, in fact, decided by Judge Squires in 1993 in the bankruptcy court, cites Ginsburg and Martin, the treatise as well, for the fact that a willful and malicious injury encompasses a broad range.
That's true,
of
but why isn't one way to think about A6 is that it's a catch-all for intentional torts that have not been defined in the preceding mm-hmm. subsection? So while in theory it overlaps, it's really intended to pick up some additional conduct.
I think it is intended to pick up additional conduct that is not otherwise provided, but I think it is also intended to pick up any tort, essentially. It's any tort where you can prove what I see to be the slightly harder standard that Geiger, Quanahua versus Geiger, set forth. Any tort where you can plead that additional standard, I think it should pick up, and it shouldn't be excluded merely because under the state law fraud claim.
It's not obvious that willful and malicious is in there in order to set a higher standard. I don't think that's true, actually. I mean, in his malpractice case, no, it's right. If it's deliberate, then it's within that. Fraud happens to be deliberate, so when they make fraud non-dischargeable, they don't have to say willful and malicious fraud. That's implicit. Mm-hmm. When they want to define another set of torts and they want to confine it to intentional, they say willful and malicious. That doesn't mean there you have to they have this theory that fires only endanger people below the fire, right? If you're in a higher floor, you're immune. The flames don't rise in this building.
If I just may answer your question, and I will finalize.
I think that Wanahua made the distinction, although the statute may not have previously set forth a distinction as to a higher standard. I think Wanahua adds this extra element. And I don't think that Congress intended to bar a particular tort that could meet an extra element. And what I'm saying here is I know I cannot meet the elements of A because A specifically excludes it, but I don't think that it was the intention of Congress to make only one tort of the myriad of torts not be allowed to be pled under bankruptcy law, as long as it could be proved under this higher standard. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel.